There we go. Okay. I grew up in a typical traditional Christian home. I remember mom and dad when I was young, they were struggling with, you know, what church to go to and stuff because we needed some spiritual guidance and influence in our life. They went to the Catholic Church for a while. They tried a Methodist church, I believe, for one session. We went to a couple different Baptist churches, and then we ended up at a little fundamentalist Bible church in Salina, Kansas, where I grew up. And that was an interesting experience growing up in a fundamentalist church. You got to hear all the typical evangelistic sermons, the hellfire and the brimstone and all those kinds of things, which really, in my case, did me a lot of good, despite the way that I went for a few years of my life. I attended Calvary Bible College in Kansas City, Missouri, graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Pastoral Studies, which really is a pretty much useless degree in my opinion, and it did me very little good. I did go in the ministry, was in a church for almost 2 years and found out that the ministry really wasn't about teaching and preaching and learning to love people. It was about people starting fires and you having to fight them all the time. And being incredibly poor, which was good enough for us, I think the church felt. Anyway, spent some time in business, felt a call to go back to school, and went to Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. That was definitely a very interesting experience. I won't go into all of that, but it was a Southern Baptist Seminary that was in Kansas City. We moved back there so I could go back to school. Had a really good time there, actually. It was right after the conservatives retook the Southern Baptist denomination, and they cleaned out the seminaries. They got rid of all those stinking liberal professors and put in good conservative men and women to teach classes. And it really was a pretty good experience during the time I was there. And I went to pastor another startup church. Well, this church was a startup church, and made it there 19 months before they decided that actually preaching some of the things you're going to hear today was intolerable. And so amazingly enough, when you're in the ministry, most ministers won't go on vacation. And I found out why. Because when you do, you come back and they hand you your walking papers. So anyway, very interesting time in the ministry. I got to meet a lot of different preachers, men studying for the ministry, and I found out kind of from the inside out that a lot of what is going on in the church today is marketing. And the Southern Baptists, as much as I appreciated the time I was there and the things I learned when I was at seminary, one of the things I learned was that, you know, if you don't have a solid marketing plan for your church, you're really not planning on your church to grow, which begs the question, whatever happened to the Spirit of the Lord moving amongst people, pagans and atheists and agnostics and believers alike, so... During one of the points of my time where I, or my life, where I began to wonder about, does this book really say what we think it says? Having been in seminary and Bible college and looking at the Greek texts and different things, and Dr. Alan Thompson at Midwestern said one day in class, a true scholar in the Greek text, he said, the New Testament is not written in Koine Greek. He said that's a myth that the church is promoting. He said Koine Greek actually reads much better than the New Testament texts. We have somewhere around 30,000 Greek texts that have been unearthed. Those texts are any wide range of things, anywhere from shopping lists to ship manifests to the names of slaves that are held on a plantation somewhere to biblical texts. And certainly with the New Testament, no single book of the New Testament has been unearthed in its entirety, other than the book of Jude. We just haven't found a whole Brit Chadashah, or Brit Hadashah, as it's pronounced in Hebrew, a whole New Testament from early in the church's history. And we don't have even a complete book of Matthew, or Mark, or Luke, or John, any of those. And if you read the textual critics, we have over 30,000 textual variants from the New Testament because so many different words were changed and rewritten in such a way. It's felt by some of the best Greek scholars today, and their number is small but seems to be growing, that probably the New Testament was not written in Greek. It may have been written in Hebrew. And it's interesting that if you go into some of the Messianic synagogues, they may have a copy of the Brit Hadashah, the New Covenant, written in Hebrew. And what was done was that they took the Greek text and simply back-translated it using common Hebrew words and produced a text that seems to read very similarly to much of the Old Testament. And much of it is chantable, as you will hear when you go to a synagogue and the scriptures are read, they're chanted. Much of it chants very nicely. So there's some real thinking that maybe even the very first autographs from the pens of the Talmidei of Yeshua, his disciples, was actually in Hebrew. So, which really begs the question, does the text really mean what it says? And does it really mean what the church that I grew up in says it says? And basically, after spending about 10 years in synagogues, conservative, orthodox, and messianic in Kansas City, and doing a lot of studying, just reading on my own, because I have this question that it just seems to my head to beg to be answered, what does the text say? I found a real key, though, in all of this, and this is nothing original to me. I'm not devoting to you or disclosing to you some secret of the Passover blessing and going to sell you a book for $24.95 if you give it to my ministry. I'm not going to ask you to give me a Rolls Royce because I'm going to give you some secret law or some secret principle like these TV preachers or something like that. This is common knowledge. This is common knowledge in rabbinic thought and rabbinic circles. Okay, so what we're going to deal with today is just three little passages of Scripture, and we're going to talk about the Hebraic, the Hebrew idioms in the New Covenant. So what is an idiom? And I'm going to try and stick with my notes because I kind of have a tendency to wander with this. So I'm just going to kind of hit this. And if you have some questions at the end, I'm more than happy to take some questions, okay? What is an idiom? An idiom is a structure within a language that contains a portion of history, culture, philosophy, religion, or even a thought that's commonly understood by the culture of its source. If you look on answers.com, it says idioms are phrases that cannot be understood from the literal meaning of words. Okay, for instance, English, American English, is full of all kinds of idioms. Well, he kicked the bucket last night. Poor Tom. He kicked the bucket. Well, what does that mean? Mackenzie, what does that mean? He kicked the bucket last night. He died. All right. But if you translate that into, say, Russian, that Tom kicked the bucket last night, what are they going to think? It means nothing, all right? We have all kinds of things in English. She's cool. Think about that. If you translate that, say, into Swahili, you know, an African language. Oh, well, her body temperature must be less. Okay, she must be standing in the shade. Put your John Hancock here, all right? It means sign your name. That was based upon, you know, John Hancock writing his name really big on the Declaration of Independence so King George could read it without his glasses. Very much flying in the face of King George. Some idioms are even just numbers. Well, he's busy 24/7. Well, what does that mean? He's busy all the time, every day of the week, 24 hours a day. That man just plain old busy. Okay? Doesn't sleep very much. He's just busy. Another one you might think of is 9/11. It's a very sharp, pointed idiom we have in English today, particularly in America. 9/11 means something. Used to mean I had to call 9/11 last night. Well, that meant you called the cops, or you called for ambulance, or fire, or someone to come help you. Well, now 9/11 means 2001, September 11th, the day the earth stood still, or so we think in America. And we all remember where we were on 9/11. Those of us who are old enough to remember that. These things are called Americanisms, and all cultures contain idiomatic structures within their languages. The same is even true of some subcultures within the major culture. For instance, I work inside the blind rehab field. From time to time, when working with people who've been blind since birth, I encounter what's called a blindism. And a blindism is a way that somebody who has never seen the world understands the world. And I can't really point one out to you or give something to you, but when I hear someone say something, it's a blindism, it's startling. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. That's really interesting. I had somebody one day, one of my students who I teach how to get around with a cane, that's the predominant part of my job, I asked her one day to take a tactile map kit, and I said, I want you to show me what an intersection looks like. Take these pieces and place them together so that these lines, it was just four pieces, make an intersection. And it took her a minute, and she got it all on there. And what she put on the piece of Velcro was an E. She thought that's the way an intersection looked, was an E shape. Whoa, wait a minute, we got some things to talk about. So we had to change some things in her thinking. One time, I ran across an idiom before I really understood what idioms were, and this was from a Wycliffe Bible translator I was talking with one day. He said that, you know, Wycliffe had this huge things going on for years where they would go to into some culture, some you know, usually some jungle culture. They'd take laptop computers in there. They would reduce their language to sounds. Then they would take those sounds, run them through the computers and do different things, and they would come up with you know, a loose translation or a paraphrase of the Bible for them. And it was always the New Testament. It was never the Old. So they always started with the New. And so this missionary told me one day, he said, you know, there's this phrase that goes on with these people, and I don't know what it means. He said, but every time somebody says this phrase, it just produces uproarious laughter. And he says, I have no idea what the context is. The phrase is this, and he told this to me. A tiger lies in the tall grass in the afternoon. And if you said that with these people around, they would just bust out laughing. They'd slap you on the back and just be reduced to tears of joy. He could never find out where that came from. In fact, one of his assistants, who was from that tribal group, he asked him one day, he says, hey, what does this mean? And the guy would just laugh and laugh and laugh and walk out of the room because he had such a stitch in his side. That means nothing to us. Right? We don't have the cultural context in which that occurred to understand what that really means. In fact, this missionary said one day, he said, you know, it's so this thing is so pervasive that if you're kind of standing around, even though I don't know what it means, he said, if we're all kind of standing around, the moment seems a little tense or something, it gets quiet, he said, I'll just throw that out there. I'll just say, well, you know, tiger does lie in the grass, lie in the tall grass in the afternoon, and people just laugh, and he gets some brownie points that way. Not a clue what it means. So really what idioms are like, they're like a little miniature time capsule within a language. A society, a history, and thoughts are not preserved in the meanings of individual words, but in the meanings of short and sometimes obtuse word patterns. So really I got three things I kind of want to communicate today, one of which is I kind of want to educate you about three really cool idioms in the New Testament, or the Brit Hadashah. I want to empower you in your walk, and I kind of want to also enlighten you about some things in spirituality from a Hebraic context, which is what the New Testament was written from, and hopefully encourage you in your lives. Turn to 1 Thessalonians for just a second here. And 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. And we're going to look at a really interesting little idiom here. So we're going to start with the first one that's easiest. And David, would you read that out loud so I can kind of preserve my eyesight a little bit to get through this here? 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. Have you got it, David? Or someone? Yeah. 5:17, I'm sorry. 5:17. Yeah.
Pray without ceasing.
There you go. Bang. I've heard a lot of great sermons about this little phrase, okay? And if you're like me, you grew up in a church, and the church, you know, you'd have missionaries come and you know, raise the money for support and things like that when they go overseas, and almost always this was the verse they chose. Also, the one in the Great Commission was another one they chose. But I heard a lot of people talking about this particular verse, and it was never within its Jewish context. Never. And why is that? Well, the church has really been about, for 2,000 years, deciding that it is not Jewish, and since the Old Testament's done away with, the Old Testament people are done away with, and now we have something new, and now we have this whole new text of the New Testament, which has nothing to do with the Old, and so therefore we just start from that point and move forward. Also ignoring its own history. Of the first 300 years of the, quote, church. Well, in order to understand this, we need to understand some things about the Jewish life. The Jewish life is about practice. It's not about feeling faithful. It's about doing acts of faith. Acts of faith and obedience to commands is called mitzvah. Mitzvah is bound up in the old covenant, 613 commandments in the Old Testament. I think it's 248 of them are positive mitzvahs, and the others are the negative mitzvahs. Positive mitzvahs are, and thou shalt do, and then there's the list of what you should do. The negative mitzvahs are, thou shalt not, okay? So positive you do, negative you don't, okay? You don't murder. That's a negative mitzvah. It's a negative commandment. We think it's positive. I mean, if you're not murdering me, it's pretty positive for me, okay? It's just a way to classify those two. So what we have, though, is practice. These deeds are many times biblical in nature, such as the wearing of tefillin. Tefillin, or phylacteries is what they're called. That's totally not the right word for it. Is the little box that Jewish men will put on their head in the morning and when they recite the Shema. That's the practice that's come out of it. Those things are also worn at time of intense personal introspection and prayer. When Jewish men want to become close to God, inside that little box, which is made from the skins of a kosher animal and prepared in a certain way, are four compartments, and the little compartments have little miniature scrolls which have verses on them. And this is the practice that's come out of that. Well, wearing tefillin is very much part of a biblical command, okay? And thou shalt do these things. It's a positive command, okay? We need to understand, though, that there's rabbinic commands as well, some of which Yeshua did agree with. Despite all the negative preaching and all this hatred that everyone has about the Pharisees and the rabbis, the fact remains that Yeshua agreed with them in many cases. And we'll get to that here in a few minutes. Sometimes, well, for instance, let me go back to tefillin for a minute. Tefillin, of course, is the little box. But again, what is this? This is a yarmulke. It's not the little box. This is rabbinic. Tefillin is biblical. Okay? Well, biblical, that's the way we want to go. Well, that's true. That's true. But there's also a thing, though, about having a life of practice as well. So we'll get to this here for a minute here. Most but not all rabbinic rulings are directly derived from scriptural principles. They are an active life embodied grappling with scriptural truth and commands. The real question that I've said over and over, and you've heard me say it in the past, is, well, how do we do this? The Bible says you're supposed to sacrifice an animal and do that. Well, how? I mean, do we beat it to death with a 2x4? Do we slit its throat? Do we shoot it with a gun? I mean, do we shoot it with an arrow? How do we sacrifice an animal? Well, that's just simple. We're just going to obey the Lord. Well, maybe some of these practices that have come out of Judaism are from obeying the Lord. But see, the church always forgets that. They do forget that there was a people who existed from 2,000 years before them who are actively struggling with the text and trying to figure out, how do we live this? How do we do this? How do we remain a people? And what unites us? So you oftentimes hear that the church will scream against Pharisaic and rabbinic pronouncements. But this right here, pray without ceasing, is not a biblical command from the Old Testament. This is not even related to any of those sermons I heard growing up. Pray without ceasing, the sages tell us, and the Talmud records, that during the time of King David, there was a plague. 100 people a day in Israel were dying from this plague. Well, the rabbis pretty quickly figured out, if 100 people every day are dying, well, this must be something spiritual. So in a time when there wasn't medicine or so many other things, and I think we should have medicine, but I also think very much we should have a component of faith and spirituality in our lives, the rabbis ordered these people to offer 100 berukah a day. And it was placed upon all Jews that every day you should offer 100 blessings to God. Well, berukahs are very interesting, and the practice that's grown out of that is that when you bless something, you bless God. In Judaism, we don't bless the meal. We bless the one who gave us the meal. In Judaism, I don't bless my wife. I bless God who gave her to me. Okay? It always goes back to the Lord. So in the idea of praying without ceasing, Paul is very much appealing to this rabbinic command that was issued at the time of David, which has never been lifted, by the way, to continue to offer 100 blessings a day. Well, probably if you grew up in a church like I did, when you first hear those things, you're like, well, wait a minute, that's just stupid. Why in the world? You know, that's just legalism. And I love that word because as it's thrown about oftentimes in religious circles, legalism really becomes anything we disagree with. Really, doesn't it? Your dress is too short. Yours is too long. Your heels are too high. Yours are too low. Well, that's just legalism. You know, crying out loud. You guys ever seen the movie Fiddler on the Roof? Well, that's my family's story. It really is. I mean, my people came from that area of Russia. During the late 1800s, the czars and czarinas in Russia declared that the Jews should not have a home. And so they kicked their people off the land. And so in 1895, my great-great-grandfather on my birth father's side came from Russia during one of those times of the pogroms. And so he came here to start his life. But anyway, there's a neat little line in that movie. And what the young man, I forget his name, who's going to marry one of Tevye's daughters, says he gets this new sewing machine. He's a tailor, and he wants to marry her because now he's got his business, and he's got a sewing machine, and he can do so much business. And, you know, and he asks the rabbi in ecstatic joy. He says, "Rabbi, is there a blessing for a sewing machine?" And the rabbi, you know, this little rabbi, he says, "There is a blessing for everything." And there is. In Judaism, you bless God for the first conscious breath you have in the morning. You bless God when you see your children's faces in the morning. You bless God when you see somebody else's child's face in the morning. You bless God for the first beautiful tree you see in that day. You bless God because the sun came up this day. You bless God because you have the strength to meet the day. You bless God because you have a wife when you see her face. You bless God when you say the morning prayers, which is called davening. If you actually say the morning prayers, you get through 43 blessings. Boom, right then, the beginning of the day. It's awesome. Well, legalism. Oh, it's legalism. That's just stupid. Let's think about it for a minute. Do you honestly think that your Mondays are going to be the same if you can walk through your day on a Monday and say 100 thankful words to God? You think the rough week you just had, and it's Friday, and you're just praying that you can have enough strength to get through to 5 o'clock. And you think on Friday, if you spent your day saying 100 blessings, looking actively for 100 things to say thank you to God for, don't you think that your day is going to change? That the whole energy in that's going to change? Well, I've done this a few times in my life. And I'm here to tell you that the whole energy of your day will change. I don't get through 100 of them anymore every day. But because God has blessed me in so many ways, I spend most of my days in an attitude of gratitude for so many things. And I'm here to tell you that it's a lot better to look for something to say thank you to God for, even if you don't feel like saying thank you, than it is to not say thank you. It's a whole lot better, even if you got to make it up. Because after a while, you start believing your own stuff, don't you? These rabbis are pretty smart. Luke chapter 11, verse 42. Yeshua had some very strong words for the Pharisees. "How terrible it will be for you Pharisees. You give a tenth of your mint and spices and every kind of herb, but you neglect justice and the love of God. These are the things that you should have practiced without neglecting the others." Okay, so immediately what we're going to think if we grew up in a church is that, well, Jesus is roasting those Pharisees, lousy Pharisees, stinking Pharisees, terrible, rotten people, you know, be in hell for the rest of their lives. They killed Jesus and they're getting everything they deserve when the Holocaust happened. All right, so all this societal programming goes into that. But what did he say? He roasted them. He said that you should be giving a tithe of your herbs, your mint, and your spices. And the question is, was that ever asked of the Jews in the, under the Old Covenant? No. Tithes weren't of spices and herbs or mint leaves. He said, so this was a rabbinic thing that came about. Yeshua agreed with the rabbis. Yeah, you should be doing those things. But you also shouldn't be neglecting the really important stuff. Let's just skip on forward here. So back to the verse. You think your day is going to be different if you actually say 100 times a day, thank you, God? I mean, I think it will. I felt it in my own life. All right, let's turn to Mark chapter 7, verse 19 for a minute. And this is the one that probably would be of some help for people around here. I mean, most of us keep kosher as best we can around here. We don't eat pork or shellfish or whatever. But people are going to throw this one in your face from time to time, aren't they? Well, let's go here. We're going to interrupt Yeshua right here in the middle of the argument about eating food. Mark 7, chapter 7, verse 19. For it doesn't go into the heart, but into the stomach, and passes out into the latrine. Thus he declared all food ritually clean. For what comes out of a person, he went on, is that which makes him unclean. For from within, out of a person's heart, come wicked thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, indecency, envy, slander, arrogance, foolishness. All these wicked things came from within, and they make a person unclean. Well, see, there you go. Pass the ham sandwiches. We're good to go. All right? And I want a side of bacon and a couple of pounds of shrimp on the side. We're good to go, right? All food. All right, right there. Yeshua said it's clean. Okay, well, again, if you take a text out of context, you don't have the proper message, okay? If we're going to understand the text, we have to understand kashrut. Kashrut are the Jewish laws, and actually these are biblical, regarding what is food and what is not. Leviticus chapter 11. From the land, and we don't have to go there and read, but I'll just tell you real quick, the summation is, from the land, you are allowed to eat an animal that has a hoof that is completely split. Okay, so it's got, you know, a split hoof, and that chews its cud, okay? Pigs have split hoofs, and it sure seems like they eat a lot. Why can't we eat pork? They don't chew cud. Rabbits chew cud, but why can't we have rabbit stew? They don't have a split hoof, all right? So we have to have both of those things in order to be permitted. From the water, whether it's salt water or fresh water, the animal has to have fins and scales. Okay? Shark. There you go. Shark steak. Anybody got any? We haven't any for lunch? No scales. Big old fins. Real big teeth, some of them. No scales. It's not permitted. Calamari. Yeah, squid legs. Chop those up nice and fine, batter them up, throw them in the grease. Mm-mm-mm. No, there's no scales and no fins. Shrimp, well, that's a whole shell is like a big scale. No, there's no fins. Someone once described to me that shrimp and the lobster are like cockroaches that live on the bottom of the ocean. So from the air, there are specific prohibitions from things that we can't eat. Eagles, vultures, offspring, kites, all buzzards, ravens, ostrich, screech owls, seagulls, all hawks, little owls, cormorants, great owls, horned owl, pelicans, barn owls, storks, herons, hoopoes, and bats. Don't have a clue what a hoopoe is? Don't know. Bugs, all locusts, grasshoppers, and crickets. Yum. You know, they got crickets now at Walmart in the sporting goods section, you know? I mean, yeah, times ever get hard. Anyway, lizards and other little crawling things are unclean. Okay? That's a pretty short list. But we need to remember something here. Clean and unclean came long before Torah did. It came even before Noah. We know that clean and unclean animals were a division that was brought upon the ark. And even before Abraham, who received, who was considered to be the first Jew in Judaism, the world knew what clean and unclean animals were. So, under Judaism, under Halakha, Jewish law, the idea is that we have food, which is clean animals, clean fish, clean birds, and clean bugs. And we have treif. Treif are non-food items. Okay, so similarly, I had this discussion with somebody at work one day. We was out to lunch. And they were wondering. So, you know, it's interesting how you get to have these discussions. And they said, well, why wouldn't you eat shrimp, Kevin? And I said, well, I mean, it's been forbidden in Scripture to those for the people of God. And there's a good church person, you know. So I got my little plug in there to ask more questions. Because the point is, I want people to ask questions. That is evangelism. Having people ask questions of why your life is different. It's the way things are supposed to be. Yeah, but isn't that like in the Old Testament? Absolutely. Yep. Jesus was an Old Testament kind of guy too. All right. So anyway, the point is this. When you have treif, eating treif to those who love God should be like eating the bottom of your shoe. It's a non-food item. I don't care if you're wearing leather soles or if you're wearing Vibram. It's all the same. It's a non-food item. So we don't eat things that aren't food. Well, I got shrimp here, and I've got a nice casserole of baleen wire. Well, which can we eat? Well, neither. They're both non-food. Okay? That's just the way it works. So anyway, that's kind of hard for some people to digest. Yeshua was solving a problem when he was declaring all food clean. He was solving a problem with kashrut. Kashrut encompasses everything about food. It encompasses the slaughtering of the animal, the dressing of the animal, cooking, and the utensils used to cook and prepare and eat the food, and what kind of company you can eat the food in. So here's how this works. Kashrut is a game that you can get to where you play in a total one-upsman role all the time. Let's say I go to Jimmy and Carolyn's house. We have a wonderful meal that Carolyn's prepared, and Jim's, you know, all fussed over with her, you know, and really contributed, and they're just, you know, they're going to honor us with a wonderful meal, and which we have been at your home several times. And we sit down at the table. It's a kosher animal. It's lamb. It's just dressed perfectly with mushrooms and the little gravy, and the wine is absolutely perfect, and the tablecloth is this beautiful, you know, beautiful white tablecloth, and it's just, it's awesome. And we're sitting there, and the mashed potatoes are steaming, and the butter's melting, and it's just going to be this wonderful meal. I cannot eat here. Why? Because the thread that's on the edge of the tablecloth, and the tablecloth is cotton, the thread, I feel, is now wool. It's a mixed cloth. I can't eat here because the meal now is invalid. That's the kind of stupidness you get with kashrut. It can become that silly. So now all we have is offended people, offended hearts, broken waste of time and money. And now Jimmy and I have this thing against us now, between us. Okay? This kind of stuff was going on at the time of Yeshua. It still goes on today. We have multiple levels of kosher. Glot kosher is the most kosher there is. It's kosher beyond kosher. In fact, what you do with glot kosher is you not only wash the dishes, which have been prepared by a Jew, by the way. These dishes are, the clay is handled by Jews. It's fired in a kiln that was built by Jews. It is Jewish all the way through. Gentiles have never even looked on these plates. This is so kosher. The animals are prepared and slaughtered by rabbis. I mean, this whole thing just goes on and on and on and on and on. Okay? Becomes now that the little $5 hamburger is going to cost you about $60, you know, because we've had to pay all these people to be so kosher along the way. Glot kosher is amazing because you can take the dish. It's been washed. It's been completely, you know, I mean, it's all biblical. Well, now we have to baptize each dish individually, set it up so it doesn't touch the other dishes. And we have to do so in a total Jewish environment where no Gentiles are present. Okay? And you can't even eat the food once it's taken out into the serving area where a Gentile is present. Okay? You just can't do it. That's glatt kosher. Okay? That's amazingly, I mean, you can't, how do you live that way in West Tennessee? How do you live that way anywhere? You know? You just can't. But kashrut gets very, very crazy. So, Yeshua said, you guys are focusing on the wrong stuff. Kosher animal? It's kosher. Eat it. Okay? Deer is a kosher animal. Split hoof. Chews its cud. There's a problem with it, though. In conservative and orthodox circles, deer are not domesticated. You don't take a deer, drag it down, you know, out there running in the woods, you know, drag down this deer, and then you slit its throat while saying the blessings. You don't do that. You predate a deer. You shoot a deer. You hunt it down. Okay? The rabbis have said you can't eat an animal that's been predated upon. So, I've had some deer lately. Deer sausage. Christian makes some good deer sausage. It's a kosher animal. So, I'm just kind of content to go kosher as much as I can be and trust God for the rest, which was some great advice I got from a rabbi one time. Yeshua's main problem with the rabbis was the attitude that comes from a lost focus, a lost love for the Lord. Not all the rabbis have lost their love of the Lord. I've spoken with many people, and I tell you what, if there's somebody you want to have lunch with and enjoy a meal with, and someone who's just gracious and kind, usually it's a rabbi. It really is. I've had some amazing conversations with rabbis about all kinds of things. And usually not the sports, because I don't follow sports. Many of them do, though. Which is a testament to me about what a life of Torah observance does. It usually makes you kind and loving and caring for people. Well, let's move on here real quick. Well, let me just skip down here. You know, Peter got the whole point about kosher as well. In Acts chapter 10, verse 28... Let me just read that. He said unto them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. But God has showed me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Not eating with non-Jews, by the way, was a rabbinic command. The rabbi said, if you're a good Jew, you're not going to eat with these stinking Romans. You're not going to eat with these stinking Philistines. You're not going to eat with anyone other than a Jew. Okay? Time of intense persecution was going on. Okay, Jews were literally struggling for their lives and for maintaining their identity. So the rabbinic command went out: don't eat with anyone who's not a Jew. Okay, which was one of the things you see Yeshua modeling for us, is that he did eat with people who were not Jews, and he ate with tax collectors. I've never ate with a tax collector. At this point, I'm not intending to. As my father said, don't tell him where the bullets or the bullion is at. So anyway, Yeshua was confronting a biblical or a rabbinic command that was not going to be helpful to the question of how do we spread his message. If you can't sit down with somebody and discuss religion over a glass of wine or with a cup of coffee or sharing a hamburger, there's not much you can talk about with that person. And there's not much they're going to listen to you about either. The thing with Peter was, if you remember the vision he had, was that the sheet came down and on it were all manner of unclean food. And the Lord said, take and eat. And Peter said, no, I didn't have any of this stuff since my birth. And the Lord said, well, don't you call any man clean that I've called clean. The problem was in the early church was that they were the early church. I don't even like the term church, really. it doesn't designate what was going on. That during the time, the messianic followings, the messianic period here that we're talking about, what was happening was Jews who'd received the word were trying to struggle with how do we allow Gentiles into this. This was an exclusive club before. Now we've got the doors open. Well, do we treat them just like us? Do we get to eat with them or not? There was problems. Apparently, Peter was not eating with believers whom the Lord had cleansed. And the Lord sent him a vision. And it's interesting that Peter actually got the question. He said he didn't argue about the food afterwards. We don't see Peter going and eat a ham sandwich and with a side of shrimp cocktail or anything. He was talking about the man question. The church focuses on the food question, which they inappropriately trump with the Jesus question we just talked about. Anyway, let's move on. Let's move on to our third idiom here. But in order to get there first, we need to talk about tallit. Okay? Tallit are prayer shawls. Okay? See me sporting my model here. Jimmy has one on. David oftentimes wears one. Well, what's the big deal about prayer shawls? Well, they need to be understood in the Jewish context, and they do occur in the New Covenant. But you have to understand the idiomatic ways in which they're referred to in order to understand that they're there. Okay? So let me just quickly go through this here, because I think this is a powerful word picture. Tallit are beautiful garments, I think. I'm going to hang this right here for a minute. Originally, they were just white. They were white garments made out of either linen, which is cotton, or wool. Okay, tallit are pretty cool because Yeshua wore one, and we know that from many different passages, and we don't have time to go into them all. But let's talk about tallit for a minute. This is the unhemmed edge, the portion that the Lord told us at Mount Sinai. So these are biblical garments. He told us not to hem these things. A four-cornered garment, it does have four corners. I placed them all together here. They are commanded to have a blue thread on them and a tassel. This is what has grown out of this, is a wrapping of the blue thread around the other one. So the shamash, the servant thread, is blue. This blue is not just a blue thread. And some of you may have heard this, but this blue is made from a special snail that was discovered again after being lost, we think, for thousands of years in the Mediterranean Ocean just off the coast of Israel. 12,000 snails give their lives in order to give 1 gram of blue dye. 12,000. It's their blood. So these strings are dipped in the blue blood of these snails. The last I heard, about 4 or 5 years ago, you know how you can take a swatch of color into Lowe's and they put it underneath that machine, that what they call a chromograph, and it separates out the color mixtures, and then you can take that color and they'll mix, you know, a custom color to that to match. Last I heard, they still haven't figured out how to match this color exactly, even using computer-aided chromography. It's truly a singularity in nature. There is nothing else quite like it. At one time I look at it, it looks light blue. The next time I look at it, it looks dark blue. I mean, you see it under different lights. It's just different. I don't quite understand. Tallit are finished with the knots. These are specially combed out here at the edge to fray them this way, and they're tied. This one was prepared by a rabbi in Israel because I, at the time, didn't know how to tie the knots. The zitzis, these things here, the tassels, are hung on the garment in a certain way. They're hung and tied at just a point so that the garment has to bend a little bit to show that it is affixed to the garment, okay, not that it's just dangling from it. The zitzis actually correspond to the name, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I don't say that name. It's part of my practice and tradition, and it's part of what most observants do. Is we just don't say the Lord's special name, but once a year on the Day of Atonement. So this represents the Lord. It represents His commandments. Okay, this garment here really has no special purpose other than to display the tzitzis on. Okay, And it's interesting because if you understand in a spiritual sense what a tallit, this covering, means to a Jewish man, this is his righteousness. In a spiritual sense, as you go through life and as you obey mitzvah and keep Torah and learn to be more observant and are kind and generous to people, which is all, those are all biblical commands, the Jews say that in a spiritually, your tallit grows longer. Okay? It's just a spiritual principle. It's a philosophy. It's not in Scripture. Okay? And I'm happy to state that. Okay? In fact, Yeshua got angry with some of the Pharisees because they were embroidering the hems on their tallit. And so they were walking around with these regal trains, showing that they were more righteous than the other people. So if you could afford to have longer tallit than others, you could kind of sport around. Tallit are not Jewish bling, okay? They're not a thing to be worn in pride, okay? These are special garments. This is part of what you are buried with as a Jewish man. It's wrapped around you. It symbolizes your righteousness, and which has a lot of neat word pictures, I think, associated with that. So there's a lot of different practices that have come out from this, one of which is when you put it on, you thank God for commanding us to surround ourselves with his commands. And that's the blessing that's said. It's then placed over you. You cover your face. And then you deal with managing this garment. Okay, so it's put back on. You can wear it a multitude of different ways. This is your prayer closet. You'll find that in various Hebraic texts. This is your prayer closet. During a time of intense prayer, or a time when you just want to feel closer to the Lord, you pull the garment up, you pull it a little more forward, so that you kind of have more of a focus. You're not so distracted with things. Again, in Judaism, spiritual truths usually have a physical corresponding reality, which is acted out. Okay, that's why the scriptures say that the temple, the Mishnakan, the tabernacle, are all shadows of what's in heaven. Which is interesting because the physical reality is not as real as we think it is. That it's the spiritual reality, which is really what reality is. When Jewish men pray, and sometimes women will wear these things as well, during a time of intense devotion or when they want to feel close to the Lord. When we say the Shema, we turn to the east. We cover our face to hide us from the glory of God, which we are commanded to remember being at Sinai with. And we say, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Baruch Shein Kavod, Mahuto Le'olam Vayed. And that's the Shema. And we say that three times a day, which is what Yeshua said. When a man is wearing his tallit and he's davening, which usually means he has the shawl up over his head and he has it usually wrapped around him, he'll have a siddur, his prayer book, and he'll be doing this, okay? You don't stand within 3 feet of a man wearing a tallit with this. Why? It's interesting. The thought is that when we pray, our prayers don't go up to God. He comes down to receive them. We make room for the Shekinah, the Shekinah, the Shekinah of God comes down to hear our prayers. That is really a whole lot different than what the Catholic Church taught us, where we have to light candles and the prayers go up on the smoke. Okay? God comes to us when we're praying. I think that's a powerful word picture. That says that he is ready to drop whatever he's doing, so to speak, and come hear you. The one who runs the universe wants you to make room in your life, 3 feet, so he can come visit you. I think that's pretty powerful. You'll see in the New Testament this garment appear a few times, and I keep finding stuff as I read more, but anyway. So this is about the tallit. The black stripes, by the way, were added after the destruction of the temple. This is a sign of mourning. You'll see the black stripes, particularly in Orthodox and Hasidic synagogues. We covered the blue thread. The windings on here are wound a certain number of times to correspond to the numeric the numeric value of the letters in Hebrew that correspond to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Every time the knot is twisted and tied, we say L'shein HaTorah, which is bless the Torah. And so that is part of what is done as those things are tied. Keaton, my son Keaton, stand up. He's wearing a tallit katan, so model it for us, the pose and all that. Tallit katan are worn underneath the clothes. They were originally designed so that observant men could be observant by having the strings tucked inside their pant legs, okay? So those things, you walk along and they're tickling your legs, you know? But the tallit is to be seen, the tzitzit is to be seen, okay? So now, because we're a little freer in this country and we don't have so much persecution, it's pretty easy to wear those things and not take a lot of heat for it. Okay, so let's move on here real quick. The tzitzits are allowed to touch the ground, by the way. Well, that's just dragging God's name in the mud. Well, no, in Judaism, we feel that our religion that God has given us is an earthly religion, that it has practical value here and now. And so God himself comes down to meet us on the ground. Now, we don't want to drag these things in the ground. I try not to, and I try not to step on them because they're expensive. Okay? So I try to keep things nice. Back here to Scripture. They appear several times in the New Covenant, Luke chapter 8, verse 43 through 48, the hem of his garment. The woman who had the issue of blood, you might remember this, she pushed through the crowd just so she could touch the hem of his garment, his tzitzis. Okay? Pretty important thing that she touched there. And by the way, she violated a rabbinic command. Women weren't supposed to touch rabbis. Why? Because of the issue of blood. It made the rabbi unclean at that point. Okay? Unclean is not necessarily a sin. Unclean just means you're unclean. It means you can't go to the temple until you've performed ritual cleansing rituals and got yourself clean again. It's interesting that in Malachi chapter 4, verse 2, it says that the Messiah will have healing in his wings. These are your wings. Okay? They blow around. Okay? These are your wings. At the Messiah's death, his robe and his tallit were taken from him, and they were gambled for by the Roman soldiers. You might remember that. After, in Matthew chapter 27, after he was nailed to the stake, they divided his clothes among them by throwing dice. In the New Testament, you might find the word for tallit being translated as cloak, garment, raiment, vesture, or hem of his garment. But if you look at Matthew 23, verse 1, you see that Yeshua addressed the crowds and his Talmidim, his disciples, and the Torah teachers and the Pharisees. He said, "You sit in the seats of Moshe, so whatsoever they tell you to do," he was talking to the people, he was talking about the Pharisees, "you do what they tell you to do, but don't do what they do, because they talk, but they don't act. And they have heavy loads, and they place them upon the people's shoulders, but they won't lift a finger to help carry them. Everything they do is done to be seen by others. For they make their tefillin broad and their tzitziot long, and they love the place of honor at banquets and at the best seats in the synagogues, and they love being greeted deferentially in the marketplace and being called rabbi." Pride creeps in everywhere, doesn't it not? Even among some of the most religious and observant and quiet people, people can become very proud. I'm just going to skip on here because I don't want to keep you guys too long this morning. Mark chapter 5, verse 35 and 43, we read that Yeshua took the child by the hand and he said to her, "Talita kumi." And the text says, by the way, in the Bible, there's a problem with the text in this particular case. The text says that it's interpreted, "Damsel, I say to you, arise." Okay, there's a problem though, because talita kumi does not mean, "Little girl, get up." What it means is, "Come to my tallit." If you understand the word picture there, I think this is very powerful, by the way. If you understand the word picture, this little girl was dead. Yeshua rises there. He puts one hand under her, and then he says, in the matter of Jewish prayer, he would hold one side up, displaying the tzitzis, and he would say, "Little girl, come to my tallit." So he pulled this little girl to his chest as he healed her. So God hugged this little girl back to life. He's done an amazing thing. This is the whole point of today. I wanted to get to this here. Come here, Keaton. You'll read over and over in the New Testament about righteousness being imputed to someone. If you go into a synagogue today, and we've had the pleasure of doing this, when the Torah scroll is taken out of the ark, there's a big box in the back, and this Torah scroll is taken out, and it's processed up and down the aisle so that all the people can have access to it. It is a picture of God being among his people and God's word moving among his people. And so what happens is as this comes by, and Keaton, let's just kind of line up here like the scroll was going to come here. As the scroll comes by, people will take their tzitzis, they will touch the scroll as it comes by and kiss it. Or they'll take their siddur, touch the scroll, kiss it. A lot of kissing in Judaism. They'll take the yarmulkes off, place them on the scroll, and kiss the yarmulke. Okay? It says we love the Lord. Okay? So that's a practice that has come out of observance with talit. And everyone does it. The women do it. The men do it. The kids do it. It's a big deal. It's a time of joy. So the Torah, God's word, moving among his people. If at some point in time someone is there who's not properly attired to do such a thing, you might see this happen. You might see a man take his talit and put it over another man, and as it comes by, they'll do that. Okay? In a physical sense, this is a physical picture of a spiritual reality of my righteousness covering my son. Okay? This is not imputed righteousness. This, Keaton, stay here. This is what Yeshua did for us. He covered us with his righteousness. When we are clothed in the righteousness of Christ, when you read that in the New Testament, that is a physical picture of what that spiritual truth looks like. He gave us his righteousness. Now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me that praying with a towel on your head, which is what this has been called by people, has a real spiritual significance that the church has given up and is now ignoring. I think this is an impactful picture, don't you? This is what Yeshua did for us. When he died on the execution stake for us, he died so he could give us his talit. I think it's very important that his physical talit has long passed. It's obviously been destroyed or lost or whatever, and nobody has that today. Can you imagine what wars would be fought over that? We spiritually have a truth that is more real than physical reality. This was given to us by the Lord. This is what he did in the temple when he worshiped. This is how he prayed. So, thank you, Keaton. If you ever wonder about your faith and why Jews do some of the crazy things they do, the reason we do these things is because we are trying to live out spiritual truth in a physical existence. And it's difficult, and it's misunderstood. There's a wonderful little book out. It's not real big. It's called To Be a Jew, and we have a copy at home. And it talks about Jewish life and ritual and what these things mean. One of the really important things I think it says in there, despite all the other great stuff it says, is this. It says, and I believe Rabbi Paul agreed with it in Romans chapter 14, but it says this: if you think there's only one way to be observant, you're probably wrong. Okay? This isn't about solving arguments or fights or winning arguments with your neighbors who think you're crazy or whatever because you're keeping kosher. This really is about calming your own spirit so that you can live quietly and peaceably and humbly before your God. And if the rest of the world wants to go to hell in a handbasket, you're just there as a quiet, peaceful reminder of what observance and what the life of Torah and what the life of following our Rabbi Yeshua means. That's all I got today. And I hope that encourages you somehow, and I hope that empowers your life a little bit somehow. And let's eat. So,
know all of you enjoyed Kevin's message and all the information. I really did. Maybe we'll be able to have him do some other things in the future. I think we would enjoy knowing further truths. Right now, I'd like to see if everybody would stand. David, let's get our blessing to God, to us, and the blessing from us to each other. Let's all read this together. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lifteth His countenance on you and give you peace. Amen. Let's bow your